hide from the facts on who you are because you're watching that garbage.
You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM Accra, hands-on community radio for Greene and Columbia counties.
Oh, honey, I just heard some terrible news.
What's that, honey?
The radio station WGXC is going off the air.
Oh, my goodness. Did you know you could donate by check? Give them a check to WGXC 5662 Route 23, Accra, New York, 12405.
And you can also go to their website, wavefarm.org or wgxc.org, and donate monthly, a sustaining supporter.
Oh, I'll be a sustaining supporter, honey, once we get up to that St. Charles Hotel.
Oh, yes, I love the bar there.
There's no bar there.
That's what I meant.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Gemini Construction, a full-service contracting firm specializing in complete electrical construction services. Gemini Construction, serving Greene and surrounding counties for over 40 years. For more information, contact 518-622-9829.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Marilyn R. Prof. of Holiday, Florida. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Give me liberty or give me death.
WGXC, the station that gives you liberty.
During the start of the lockdown, when people couldn't travel more than 2 kilometres from their houses, we had more listeners than ever because they realised, oh, the college radio station is one of the few things that could keep going. Everything else was closed down, but we were recording news bulletins, we're doing stuff live from our kitchen. I'm doing this live from my kitchen right now. So that's a huge thing that college radio stations have.
Welcome to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. I'm Paul Rees-Mandel.
Hello, everybody. Eric Klein here.
And I'm Jennifer Waits.
And today we're here to celebrate an anniversary, a birthday of sorts, and it should be a lot of fun. We get to talk with some folks at one of our affiliate stations. It is the furthest away from any of our abodes here on the West Coast of the United States. We're going to go virtually to Galway, Ireland. And we're very happy to welcome from the National University of Ireland, Galway, and Flirt FM, we have Paula Healy, who is the station manager of Flirt FM. Welcome, Paula.
Thank you so much. And I'm amazed that you don't have your station in an Antarctica that you visited before broadcasting, or I don't know which is further.
Yes, probably Antarctica. I don't know. Not a great geographer, but if only we could have them on as an affiliate. And we also welcome the founder of Flirt FM, as well as a lecturer in English and Media Studies at NUI Galway, Andrew O'Boyle.
Hi, glad to be here. Very, very excited.
We are celebrating the 25th anniversary of Flirt FM, which is the community and university station there at the university in Galway. And just about a week ago, I had the distinct pleasure of talking with Andrew on the air there at Flirt FM as part of your 25th anniversary marathon. And so it's really nice to be able to speak with you again so quickly. Andrew and I attended graduate school together for a time. He finished, I did not, at the University of Illinois Institute of Communications Research. And so it's nice always to catch up. And Jennifer has had the opportunity to tour Flirt FM and has written that up at Radio Survivor. So we will definitely put that into our show notes. To start off here, Paula, can you tell us a little bit about Flirt FM? What kind of station is it and what kind of programming does it feature?
Okay, well, we're a community of interest station where you'd have maybe 21 community radio stations, but of those stations, only four of them would be considered community of interest. There's ourselves, Ward FM in Limerick, there's UCC 98.3, actually there's five. There's Life FM, which is a religious station in Cork, and then there is Radio and Liffa in Dublin, which is an Irish language only station. So we're kind of like the little stations that are a bit more niche. So I think the biggest thing about the station is that we are open to as many people as possible to come in. We just try and train in as many people as we can physically fit in. These days you can't physically fit in anybody, so that's going to be a challenge. But as for programming, the moment we are running a schedule that runs from 11:30 in the morning till 4 a.m, that's weekdays, and then 1 p.m. to 10 p.m. at weekends. If that seems like the hours are a little bit strange, that's because we're beholden to the Broadcasting Authority and our programme policy statement. We have to do 20% of our talk has to be current affairs, and we have to do a certain number of news bulletins. So if we go longer, we need somebody sitting there doing the news for longer and, you know, making more current affairs, which, as every station knows, current affairs is the most time consuming and the most difficult. So so we kick off with a bit of news, and then we do magazine shows. We've got a flagship news show at 5 p.m. every day, which is actually broadcasting right now. And then after that, we move into something called a happy hour, which is 2 hours long. I guess that's how long it lasts in bars as well. And then we go into specialist music nights, where Monday is a bit of metal. There's also some J-pop and some psychedelic. Tuesday is indie and alternative. Wednesday we call left field because it is quite frankly anything as long as it's a bit weird. Thursday is soul and dance. And Friday night is some Irish language, some trad, some jazz, a bit all over the place. And then on Saturdays it's kind of an omnibus where we do some sports shows and stuff. So we'll have people on from transition year students, which would be a kind of a gap year in secondary school. So they might start off in the station when they're 16, and I don't want to say how old the oldest person is because, you know, he might kill me, but they're definitely, you know, 50s, 60s, and occasionally I think we've had people in their 70s, so it spans a lot.
So you've got both students at the university involved as well as volunteers in the community then?
Some volunteers from the community. What we'd say is we have to give spaces to students first and foremost. So if students apply, until we fill up all the spaces, and then after that, if we've got spaces left, we'll give them to members of the community, particularly if the members of the community want to do stuff in, if they want to do it in Irish, if they want to do current affairs, if they want to do something that students are not always 100% psyched for. We'll definitely invite members of the community in too. And just looking back over the last couple of years, we on average will interview 600 community groups a year as well. You know, just our community actors or individuals or however it might be. So there's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, this setup should sound familiar to folks who are sort of familiar with community and college radio in the United States. As Jennifer can attest, there are many college stations that also, you know, really do this sort of community service model and kind of split it up, you know, have volunteers in the community who supplement the students as well. What's interesting to me, though, is you noted that I guess it's your telecom regulatory authority, requires that you broadcast 20% public affairs programming, right? Did I get that correct?
Yeah. 20% of your talk has to be current affairs. Now, you can actually decide what your equivalent of current affairs is, because what's current affairs for one radio station is not the same depending on your cohort. But yeah, pretty much. So the longer you keep going, the more current affairs you have to do. So that is why I'm not particularly keen on running the 24/7 schedule that we were over lockdown. If I ever want to sleep again, we won't be going back to that too soon.
Paula, how do you define public affairs? What sort of programming do you air?
So we'll do things like community listings guides, straight up, like announcements, what's going on in the community diary. We'll do news bulletins. We have a talk show where we interview people about current affairs every day at 5. Then probably 4 news bulletins. Then we'll have some sports bulletins as well. And it just, there's also another caveat that you need to have 2 hours of current affairs between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. But the funny thing about that is, even if we went on air at 6 p.m, we'd still need to fit 2 hours of current affairs into 1 hour. It's just the way it works. So, you know, that's peak time for other stations, I guess. So any other current affairs, we do like arts coverage as well when we have somebody who wants to do arts. And sometimes we'll have global shows. Sometimes we'll have politics specific shows, lifestyle shows. And there might be other entertainments, arts, kind of Formula One, wrestling. You never know what people are going to come in and want to do in a given year.
And you mentioned that you have your station is called a community of interest station. There's five of those in Ireland. Is this a requirement of all of those stations, this 20% current affairs?
Oh, not even the five community of interest stations is actually a requirement for pretty much every radio broadcaster in the country, I think. There might be some commercial youth stations that don't need to do it, or they don't seem to have very much current affairs, but I think it's pretty much the same across the board. Andrew can correct me on this one, but I think it's every broadcaster.
Yeah, this was something, it's a legislative requirement, or it was introduced originally as a legislative requirement in the late 80s. We had in Ireland until 88-89, the only licensed broadcaster, almost the only licensed broadcaster, was the state broadcaster, state-owned broadcaster, a public service broadcaster, similar to what American listeners would know as NPR. And when independent broadcasting was being introduced, there were fears of capture of the public resource that was the airwaves. Some people described broadcasting licenses as being licenses to print money. The specific instance where that was mentioned, that broadcaster actually went bankrupt very quickly. But most of the broadcasters have retained their licenses and are close to monopolies in their jurisdiction since. And there was also this concern that you were moving from a public service model to largely a commercial model. And so one of the things put into the licensing legislation in 88 and 90 was that there be this two-hour block and this 20% requirement for all broadcasters. And so initially that was something that was that commercial broadcasters were subject to when they came about in around about 1990, and then later when community and community of interest broadcasters came in, of course they had the same requirement. As Paula notes, the definition is a matter for interpretation at the local level, and then for, shall we say, negotiation between the broadcaster and the licensing authority. If the licensing authority believes you're messing about, they can pull you off on that.
In fairness, like, the radio stations always tried very, very hard to make sure that we do that, and we you know, don't take the mickey. But also as well, we set it out in our programme policy statement, which is part of the 75-page document that we had to file in 2016 for the new licence? So I'm like, I never finished college. I ran away screaming because why did I pick archaeology? But I feel like I've written my thesis. I definitely have. Like, there's annotations, there's footnotes, there's like appendices, there's a title page. I think I've done it. So yeah, that was a huge part of it. So you have to set out what your requirements are in the beginning. You have to decide, you know, how many hours of sports you'll do, what kind of community groups you'll engage with, whether you'll have youth shows. And then the other one as well is to have 20% Irish music as well, which is hugely important. And that's something that most stations will have a requirement to do, whether some do it or some don't, and whether it might be the same five songs they keep playing. Definitely not in our case, hopefully, anyway.
Right. And our friends to the Great White North will be familiar with such a requirement. In Canada, they do have a Canadian content requirement as well for their broadcast stations.
Yeah, I suppose it's French-speaking countries seem to love saying, you know, support local artists or support national artists. I do get it, though, because there's a huge amount of phenomenal talent, and we've been doing our best to support new and alternative and strange and odd and won't get airplay anywhere else. Bands will say, I'll never, you know, you're never going to hear this song in the middle of the day. And I'm like, oh, wait, hold my coffee. We're playing it right now, you know. So that's part of what we do, I think, is just make sure that we're doing as much as we can to support local artists, but also not the ones you're going to get everywhere. You know, not your man from One Direction and U2 and the Cranberries. You will get those in other stations, but we're playing the stuff that might be a little bit... It'll take a little bit longer to get used to it, I think.
Paula, So you mentioned this massive document you had to file with the government. How do you keep track of, you know, if you need to be playing a certain number, certain percentage of artists from Ireland... How do you keep track of that? Do you have to literally keep track of every song you play?
In its own way, yeah. If they come to audit us, we will have to go through song by song and figure out what each of them are. And that's why I probably spend a good 10 hours a month just going through Irish music and making it playlists. Would also be that any incidental music we play when it's station staff putting on songs in between, they're always going to be Irish, and they're always going to be new Irish artists and female Irish artists or female identifying Irish artists. So that's a huge thing we do. So fortunately, we are usually pretty well behaved, and the Broadcasting Authority know this, so they don't audit us too often. But when we do, I'll have an Excel spreadsheet open going, Irish, not Irish, Irish, not Irish, not Irish, not Irish. And then I'll see, like, there'll be shows, I can tell some of the shows aren't really pulling their weight on it, and I'll have to be like, come on, you know, we need to do this. Or if you're going to have like a Canadian music special, which we have done for Canada Day before, you're like, okay, talk to the show before you and after you and make sure that they play more Irish music to make up for when you're not. So there's the negotiations, but also I'm on top of it, and I know who's doing well, who isn't. And encouraging gently. We don't playlist. We have a playlist, but we don't playlist. It's just like, it's a folder of music that you should check out. So it's a tug between the two, because you want to make sure we do things, but also they're volunteers. They're not getting paid to be there. They still have to enjoy themselves, and you can't be just like biting their heads off going, okay, you're going to play these five songs, because they'll disappear after a while. Right. It won't be fun anymore.
I'm excited that you mentioned female artists. Is that a station policy? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
It was an impromptu station policy. We just decided that there was an awful lot of bands where it was, you know, four young lads with guitars, and a lot of them kind of sounded the same, or maybe four not even that young lads with guitars. And there's so many more interesting female artists coming out in Ireland over the last couple of years that we just said the stuff was actually exciting us a lot more, and has been for about 2 or 3 years now at this stage, which is kind of funny because... there was a piece of research done recently by a woman called Linda Coogan Byrne, which looked at the proportion of female artists Irish radio was playing. Now, it didn't include community radio because I'm guessing they just didn't have the funds to actually check out another 21 stations. But it was looking at some of the stations. None of the top 20 was female. None of the top 20 Irish plays were female at all. RTE, the state broadcaster, did actually do quite well, was 50-50. So they'd obviously made some kind of a decision. Whereas I kind of wish that they'd reported on us, because I know that we're doing a really good job. We're like 45-55, if not 50-50. So that was definitely something. And it wasn't even something that I had to decide was a thing. I think the groundswell was the last couple of years that everybody else is feeling, well, the most exciting stuff is women right now. Like one of our favourite bands, Pillow Queens, they're about to take over the world. We love them to bits, and everybody was jumping on that song as opposed to anything else from any other bands. So it kind of came about naturally, to be honest.
And Paula Healy, you are the station manager at Flirt FM, which is the community and college radio station at the National University of Ireland in Galway. And you just... completed, or you just celebrated your 25th anniversary on air. Tell us more about how you celebrated, how you shared the celebration with your listeners.
It was so difficult because the last time was about as hands-on as you can get. There was a children's crafts table where they were finger painting. There was 8 of us in a studio for 2 hours. We had a silent disco. I'm sure there was plenty of high fives and hugging 12 people to a dinner table at a gala banquet. None of that could happen this time. So I just decided... I was probably, you know, having a glass of wine. I do most of my best thinking when that happens. And I decided 25-hour live global marathon. Let's do it. Let's set up a relay and have people coming back. Because what we really wanted to do was celebrate all of the different people that have been broadcasting for the last 25 years. So we had people that had left the station 6 months ago and people that had, you know, started off in the station in 1995, invited them all back on. And because at the moment we don't have access to our building, we've been doing some shows over Zoom. We have a show called The Big Friday Show. That's two amazing presenters with intellectual disabilities. But to be honest, they're amazing, such good broadcasters that they just get it. They're actually like naturally better broadcasters than I'd say like, you know, half of the students we get in. So they were really pushing doing their live shows, and it was just a huge highlight of the week. We used to have little dance parties off camera, you know, when the songs were playing. So they kind of led the way for me thinking, do you know, we can do this. We can do this remotely. We can do this through Zoom. And then I just went, well, if we're going to do something like that through Zoom, it has to be 25 hours long, because what's the point in having a 24-hour broadcast for a 25th anniversary? So that was it. We just kind of set up. I was pretty excited when we got somebody from Vietnam and somebody from Paris and some people from America and somebody from Glasgow that was looking for the really glamorous locations, the ones that are 20 or 30 miles down the road, not so much. They're still welcome, but yeah, it was pretty good. So we got a good bit of press around it, and it was a buzz. And we got let back into the studio for one night only, which was very nice. But also, it was weird. We felt like we'd never left the studios. It was exactly the same as like the Marie Celeste. Like, you know, there was like I think there was like a chocolate bar left on top of the sound desk that somebody had never eaten and just left there, and it was still good. We ate it. But at the same time, though, nobody was coming in to visit us, so it was a little bit weird. It was nice. We're like, you know, sitting there like looking at people while they're broadcasting to us from Seattle or, you know, from Mayo or wherever it might be. So a very strange occasion, but I think it worked well. It worked about as well as you could do. It still felt like a celebration. And I think everybody still left with really big smiles on their faces, and the feedback from listeners was really, really good as well.
And that's wonderful. How long have you been with the station, Paula? How long have you been the station manager?
I'd say it's probably about the 1870s. I feel like I've been there for forever.
We know since community radio years are entirely different from, you know, it's sort of like dog years in that way, right?
I started in NUI Galway, or UCG it was called back then, in 1998. And somebody who I'm still friends with, Erica King, was the auditor of Radio Sock, and she persuaded me to join. Didn't take much persuading. I was a radio nerd. And yeah, 1998, I did my first show. And actually, the guy I did my first show with in 1998 came back on for the 25-hour broadcast. And we were talking about how he remembers everything and I've forgotten everything because I've done so many hours of broadcast. So yeah, since 1998. And then I went over to Edinburgh for a couple of years and really, really missed doing radio. Came back in 2005 and I've been working there solidly since 2005. No sign of me going anywhere, because every time I don't have enough work to do, I'll join another committee. So I always will have enough work to do.
And you said you were a big radio nerd. So what made you love radio? What was it that you loved about radio prior to getting involved at Flirt FM?
So I wasn't probably like big on the physics, because, well, I did physics for the Leaving Cert, but, you know, I had to do pass because I couldn't derive a function to save my life. So not quite that way. But I'd always be listening out for like the music I wanted to hear that I couldn't hear anywhere else, because I'm going to, you know, age myself even worse now saying, you know, you don't have Spotify or YouTube. If you wanted to hear a song, you taped it off the radio and that's the only way you got it. So I'd be sitting there waiting to press tape like a lot of people would. But I found that at night during the summer, when obviously the air conditions were just right, you could sometimes pick up BBC Radio 1 from London, which felt so exotic. And then in, I can't remember what year it was, but a radio station called Radio Ireland started up. And it's Today FM these days, but there was a DJ on it called Dolan Dineen. And I absolutely loved the stuff he played. And I went, oh my God, I'd never thought. I'm like, I'd watched Chris, you know, Northern Exposure, Chris the DJ, or Christian Slater and Pump Up the Volume or something like that. And then when I heard this DJ in Ireland playing this amazing music, I was kind of going, oh God, you know, maybe that's actually something that you could do. And then when I got to college and found out that you could, it blew my tiny little mind, and I've been sunk ever since. Just couldn't get away from it.
Well, let's turn back then to the fact that, you know, there is a Flirt FM in Galway. Andrew, you founded the station back in 1995, and you were a student at the time at Galway?
Mm-hmm. I was. I'd started university in 1993, and that was just a few years, three or four years after the first commercial stations had gone on air, the first non-state broadcasters. And a little like Paula, I'd been fascinated by radio for a long time. For me, some of the things that had influenced me previously were, my father had been involved with a short-run project in the late 70s and early 80s where RTE had decided to experiment with local radio. Now, one of the reasons that they experimented with, and what they would do, was have a local FM opt out of the national broadcast. So you'd be listening to the national station on AM or FM, and then the FM signal would switch for 2 or 3 hours in the afternoon to stuff from your town or your city or your county. And my father was involved with the experiment in Galway in, I think, 79 and 80. And I remembered that from my childhood, that amazing notion that somebody you knew could be producing the stuff that came out of your radio. And so that notion, as as so many people encounter, as Paula mentioned, as being when she comes to university and realizes you don't just have to be an audience member. You can be the other side. And then later, in the late 1980s, when you had the political events in Eastern Europe, and I was involved to a certain extent with the local ham radio club, did a little bit of I didn't at that stage have my ham license, but through the club I remember DXing with Ukraine, and so that notion of reaching people far away. But when you had those political changes, I was a shortwave radio listener, and I was listening to Radio Vilnius, Radio Latvia, or Lithuania, or Estonia, as those countries were gaining independence from the USSR. And you would hear the reports of the partisans saying, the freedom loving people are on the streets and the Russians are pulling out, and so we had this previously ourselves in the 1916 rising in Ireland, where using radio as a way to declare yourself as a nation is very much as the 20th century way. And so I really, that kind of solidified my interest in radio as a social tool, as a political tool. And so when I started in university in 1993, I knew that we had just, there'd been a change of government. A local politician who's now our president, Michael D. Higgins, had become broadcasting minister. And he was a left-wing politician, sympathetic to non-commercial broadcasting, to community interests in a way that the previous centre-right government had not been. So they'd licensed all these commercial stations. I had an inkling that there would be a space for student radio. And so I approached the Students' Union. We worked together. We worked with sympathetic staff in the university. Sean McKeever, who is a head of the audiovisual services at the university, had facilitated some short-term one-week stations for what here is Rag Week, kind of a college week celebration midway through the year. And so we worked to apply for a full-time license. And it took us about 18 months to get the license, and then almost another year to go on air, which was, quick enough when you think about it. Ends up, you're held together by spit and baling wire, but it, it worked. And so, that was 1995. And I was station manager for the first year, took a year out of my studies, and then went back and completed studies after that, and handed over management to other students who again took a year out or had just completed their studies and so on.
And Andrew, what was your model for student radio at that time? How did you know that? What did you know about college radio?
Not a lot. I should say, a lot of people will point me towards movies about college radio. Or like, I can't watch them for some reason. They put me on edge when I see movies about college radio, either because they're either too true to life or they're not. I knew that. What we used as our model was very much a democratic model of access. This was about voice, about people having access to the airwaves, and also using radio as a tool for social change, for cultural change. So when I arrived at the university and when I was first involved, there were some people who were semi-professional DJs. And who, they felt that if there was going to be a college radio station, it should be theirs. They should that you should run the station with people who, really knew their music, really knew their tech, and it should be a small group. and you bring in other people as as interviewees or the like. That's not the model that we've used. Paula is, I don't know if Paula mentioned the sorts of numbers that she trains each year, but you get hundreds of stations. We've had hundreds of students each year, thousands of students since the station began, going on air, getting essentially ownership of the mixing desks themselves. And that, there's screw-ups, there's weird noises and the like. But our model from the very beginning was that notion that anybody can do radio and anybody should be able to do radio. And that's one of the things when I was station manager that I was quite proud of, that you would get people who came in saying, I'm really fascinated by this, but I couldn't do it. And some of those people went on then to do it. They spent a little bit of time overcoming anxiety, overcoming their fears of doing radio or being near radio and going on air. And one of the other things that we spent time doing with our current affairs programming, our public affairs programming, was what Paul has talked about, bringing in community groups. Some of the first radio that I did myself, we had some short-term licenses, as I said, in the run-up to gaining our full-time broadcast license. We brought in indie music artists. We brought in the Rape Crisis Centre. We brought in local activists for disability rights, for a slew of other groups. So groups that wouldn't necessarily make their way onto broadcasting, or groups that were small, or that that had a story to tell, and story, yeah, and something that would kind of show the variety of life in Galway.
Andrew O'Boyle, mm-hmm. I'm just wondering though, was there another model of radio that you were how did you know that this would work? Was there an example that you could hear or that you knew about?
So in the run-up, what we did get, so we didn't have college radio in Ireland to look at, other than these short-term stations which were being run on this kind of festival radio basis. What we did have was Ireland had a small tradition of community radio and community radio activism, affiliated with AMARC, the World Association of Community Radio. And prior to entering university, I wasn't familiar with this particular strand, but that they're founded largely out of Canada, of course, where they have a long tradition here. Australia has a long tradition in it. They had run their 1990 conference in Dublin. There were stations in Ireland that were, when we looked for our license, there were other groups across the country in urban and rural settings who were similarly doing that. And some of the staff at the university who helped mentor us, staff involved with the some of the new Irish language broadcast training programs that the university had set up around that time, were involved, were coming out of that community radio background. And so that's something where we where they helped mentor us around that broader tradition. What there was, and one other thing to mention that,
Andrew,
I suppose go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to, you had mentioned the temporary radio licenses and the festival radio in Ireland, mm-hmm. which is something that we don't have in the United States. And when I visited, I was intrigued by that because it seemed like there were a number of college radio stations in Ireland who had these sorts of licenses where they only broadcast maybe once a year. So could you just explain mm-hmm. a bit more about this idea of temporary licenses?
Sure. So in the original broadcasting legislation of the 88-90, what they introduced was the concept that you could get a license for 14 days a year. And so you could broadcast for 14 days And the idea was that I think they were thinking of it as festival radio. So you would get your local village or your local town might decide for their summer festival to put on a radio station. And so it would kind of provide a little like traffic radio for your summer festival. You know, you'd be able to do events listings and a co-program of it. And so the main people to use that in the early days were colleges, were universities and colleges, which would run 1 week mid-year or 2 weeks, one during the first week of the year and another in the early spring. In Galway, that had been done for a while, and we with the spring, and we brought it up to twice a year, and that provided a way to build a volunteer base. It's you know, and a lot of listeners may have the experience of being involved in a community or volunteer effort. You know, I know Paul's been involved with this, where you're spending time trying to build a station, and you've got several years perhaps of no radio happening, and it's very difficult to do. So it really helped us to be able to say, look, we're building towards this. It may be a few years, it may never happen. In the meantime, here's a way to think towards February, think towards September, and how we can work towards that. That has been expanded in the time since. It's a much longer time period you can do it for now. I forget the exact number, Paula may remember, but what now you've got several of the student groups in Dublin, despite being our largest city, or maybe because it's our largest city, does not have a full-time broadcast student radio station. There's a few issues. There's a shortage of citywide frequencies in the city, so it's difficult to see how you would get a station that would cover the entire city. And we have four universities inside the city area, and you've got student groups at each of them which want a station. And so there have been attempts over the years to negotiate between them to, you know, put together amalgams of proposals. That hasn't come to fruition. But what has happened is that the different student groups have applied for short-term licenses that dovetail with each other. And so you'll get one station running for a few weeks or the like, then another. And so it'll be, you know, one university for a while, then the next. And so you can kind of work together in providing a student radio experience without having, you know, a full-time radio license. And I should say, I think now the broadcast regulator sees these short-term licenses explicitly as a pilot, as a way to pilot before you go for a full-time license. So if you're a community group and you're saying we want a full-time license and you've never done a short-term station, they'll say, try a week, see how you do. Try a month and see if you want to do it on a longer term basis. And that, I think it's useful.
One thing that occurs to me,
because, yeah, yeah.
Oh, it seems like putting to go through all that work of building an FM station and only have it for a week. It's hard for me to imagine what that's like to go through that effort and only have it for a week or two.
I suppose in the case of
stations, mm-hmm. Sorry, I was going to say the stations that do it, like there's Trinity and there's Griff and loads of ones in Dublin, they'll probably have the same setup from year to year. And in fact, I think they do. So I'm thinking there's maybe like six or seven. Some of them do a bit of on air. Some of them do a bit of FM. It's kind of hard to track from year to year, but I think they're using the same equipment. And I know I was talking to some of the stations that were saying it's a bit heartbreaking to have to file the paperwork every year for starters.
You're listening to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. I'm Paul Rees-Mandel. Also joining me are my co-hosts Jennifer Waits and Eric Klein. And today we're talking about Flirt FM, a radio station at the National University of Ireland in Galway, celebrating its 25th anniversary on the air. And we're talking some about that founding time 25 years ago, because college radio, community radio, that was new in Ireland. And the airwaves had only recently opened up to commercial broadcasting after being effectively monopolized by the public service broadcaster RTE in Ireland. And, you know, on the heels of commercial radio hitting the airwaves, there became the possibility to have community and college radio. So we're learning a lot more about what radio is like in Ireland with our guest, Andrew O'Boyle. He is a lecturer at the National University of Ireland in Galway and the founder of the radio station when he was a student there in the 1990s. And we also have Paula Healy, who is the station manager of Flirt FM. And we were talking about something pretty interesting, and it's a phenomenon that we do not have in the United States, which is this sort of festival temporary license for a radio station where, you know, you can go on the air for a couple of weeks in a given year, temporarily. And Andrew noted that at this point they've expanded it in Ireland, and in fact they sort of look at it as a pilot, that if an organization or a college would like to go on the air, perhaps they should try having this temporary license first, before committing to a full-time schedule, which actually sounds amazing to me, except, but Jennifer, you noted that you have to equip up.
Yeah, who builds the station that you then only use for 2 weeks?
Yeah, but so Paula, maybe, you know, it seems like you have some experience there and can kind of tell us, you know, are folks, I mean, are they passing around transmitters? How does that all work?
Surprisingly enough, they're not actually passing around transmitters. I think what they're doing is that they're just leaving them there from 1 year to the next with the equipment. So I know off the top of my head, because I'm probably the biggest nerd about Irish student radio right now, and I seem to be the only person that's following it. There's stations like Ballyfermot College of Further Education and Griff FM and DIT Radio Society, and who else is, like, even Mars FM in Maynooth as well, just outside of Dublin, Trinity FM, and who else have we got, like Dublin Business School, and there's someone in Talla. There's a couple, there's just pockets of them up there, so they'd be running every now and again. There's Belfield FM in UCD and DCU FM as well, so they're all a huge mix. Like some of them are taking the 1 week license, some of the other ones are in-house only, because they're not allowed to broadcast outside. Some of them are online only.
Paula, what's in-house in Ireland?
Just like a closed loop. They're actually just broadcast around campus and that's it, because the college might be a little bit worried about insurance and libel and defamation, etc. So,
is that on the actual airwaves? Is that like an AM or FM broadcast, but just on campus?
Just on campus, so it's like, I think that they were aiming for something else, but the likes of Trinity FM, I know them best because they've come down and visit us every year. They just they run for 2 weeks, like a broadcast week in semester one and semester two, and they say that the most difficult thing would probably be writing the paperwork. But the temporary license, as well, as Andrew mentioned, it's turned into a pilot license that community radio stations can apply for, and you can do up to 100 days, which to some stations would be every weekend bar two. So that actually could be quite useful. That would mean you'd be a weekend radio station for the year. That could actually be as much as some communities want to do.
I love the idea, frankly, of a temporary radio station, because I think that very often there are, you know, under the monopoly model, right, that you monopolize a single frequency, there are stations, both commercial and non-commercial, I think, that actually struggle to fill all of those 24 hours a day with meaningful programming. And that's where, at least in the United States, you know, I think you see stations fill it up mostly with, you know, with basically a jukebox, right? With you know, automated playlists that may be interesting and maybe more, you know, and some stations may be more interesting than others, but not actually helmed by a human, because in some ways, when you have a license assigned to you 24/7, you know, you are sort of obligated to fill that time, especially if you want listeners to come back on a regular basis. But there may be small organizations that barely have the resource really to fill that time with live humans, or at least with live human produced programming, even if it's pre-recorded. And I would love to see a model in a place like the United States or anywhere where essentially licenses could be shared much more so, where time could be traded and folks could go on maybe for those 100 days or for weekends or whatever, and someone else could take the time For other places, it seems to me you could actually increase the diversity of the airwaves without that. But of course, when you're assigned a single frequency, I think in many ways you are really obligated to use it. And for the organizations, community radio or college radio or commercial radio that are in the place to fill the majority of those hours with original programming like Flirt FM is, it's great for that to be there. It just seems that often it's sort of like real estate. You wonder, why couldn't you put more people onto that plot of land?
There is one instance of that in the country, actually, that I can identify. Wired FM, that's based in Mary Immaculate College and LIT in Limerick, they run during the week on 99.9 FM, which is a great frequency. But on the weekends, Limerick City Community Radio take over. So they're actually the first ones I can think of that have actually shared a frequency in Ireland and do it regularly. As for the actual frequencies that get allocated, they're such small areas. They might only be like a 5 to 15 kilometre radius. So sharing a frequency wouldn't necessarily be an issue because they're not really going to overlap each other. But it's interesting to see that there is the model there and it could be replicated.
Absolutely.
How do they divide up the dial for these temporary licenses? Is it the same spot on the dial every year? How does that work?
I suppose in a lot of cases, because there wouldn't have been any other new stations coming on stream, because, again, there's probably only 40 or 50 licensed stations in the country anyway, it's up to ComReg, the communications regulator, to say what frequency allocation you get. For instance, we started off on 105.6, and when we went for our new license in 2006, I think, we got moved to 101.3. We were like, oh God, that was a surprise for us. But by and large, you will actually just end up being able to default back to the same frequency. There are some of the temporary broadcasters and some of them in geographically difficult areas like Connemara, where it's very hilly and mountainous and there's lots of sheep. You get two frequencies because you can't cover wow. your particular franchise area. So it's done by the communications regulator. But that I would say that probably, unlike Dublin, the rest of the country is not as jammed for the frequencies. You're not as precious about having to allocate bandwidth to people.
And for those listening who are familiar with the American system, it's very different. Unlike if you're applying for an LPFM license in states where you have to go out, do the engineering work and propose the frequency, in Ireland it is very much you apply, the broadcast regulator says there's a proven social or economic need for the station, you tender for that, and then the telecommunications regulator, a separate regulatory body, are the ones who do the engineering work and says, okay, here's where you can go on the dial.
So Andrew Boyle, you founded Flirt FM 25 years ago there in Galway, and you said, basically after getting the license grant from the government around 1994, it took about a year to build the station and get it together. And I wonder, was that something which the university funded? Did you fundraise outside the university? How were you able to do that and get the resources together to put this station on the air?
Mm-hmm. It was funded by the university. We'd got a commitment from the university and also from a second, third level institution, what's now an IT, an Institute of Technology here in the city, to collaborate on it. So that IT has since pulled out of the partnership during the recession. And so it's now an NUIG only operation. But essentially the two university, or the university and the IT, had split on a 2-to-1 basis their financial commitment to support the station in its modest capital needs, and then also in its operations for the first 18 months or so. So we I think we got our funding, our initial capital funding was 10,000 or 15,000 pounds, so about $20,000 just in capital, and then for each year again about $15,000 running for the first year, so $20,000-$25,000 for the first 18 months. So it was it was in broadcasting terms, somewhat peanuts. It was a very shoestring operation, but we were lucky that the two institutions came in there. What happened then was that shortly after the, so that we got our full-time license was part of a pilot of community radio that the broadcasting authority ran. And then we got, after some extensions of the pilot period, we got longer-term licenses. So now we're operating on something like, you know, 10-year licenses. During that, as that pilot period wrapped up, we did secure funding. We got secured backing from the students' union and from the student body on campus. So funding for the station is largely comes from student capitation. It's a student fee that is charged to all students at the university. And that, so that's a self-tax by the student body, which does something in terms of your accountability to the student body. You've got to make sure, you know, every so often at any institution where a student body taxes itself, you'll get somebody who comes along and says, you know, I could save $5, $20 if we got rid of this or if we trimmed that. So you've got to make sure as a station that you have that legitimacy, that you have that buy-in across the organization. And so, you know, in blunt terms, it helps to ensure that you are embedded in the community, whether or not you are, you know, in nominal terms, a community station. But having that notion of you know, the students' union knows that you're a way to organize and reach the student body. Those who are involved in different types of sports on campus know that this is a way to get information about news about sports. Those who are involved in student drama knows here's a place where you can try some avant-garde projects. And so so it's something that we were lucky to get that funding source because the university only had so much sympathy or so much interest in funding us on a long-term basis. And so the fact that we had allies within the students' union or within the student community who pushed the referendum and then the funding package for us was something that helped secure our long-term stability.
So that student support and community support that's so important today, if you think back to 25 years ago, Andrew, did you have mm-hmm. to convince the university, did you have to convince university officials that it was valuable to have a radio station? What was that process like beyond the money? I know that sometimes yeah. college radio stations have an incredibly difficult time at convincing administrators that it's worth having a radio station.
So it's a split, right? Because they, you know, administrators are they're a single entity, but also they're individuals inside of that. So we had, I mentioned earlier, Sean McKeever, who had been involved in the local broadcasting efforts run by RTE in the early 80s, who was involved in running a long-running magazine for the blind out of the university. So had sympathy for this community effort, sympathy for broadcasting and student broadcasting. He worked with us, and another sympathetic figure was one of the vice presidents of the university, who had spearheaded a lot of community initiatives. So they secured nominal backing initially, but there was a lot of reticence, particularly on those who were responsible for balancing the books. We had to work hard to secure the funding, to get the checks that were promised to actually end up in our bank account, to get the university to provide the space. You know, more, you say, you know, beyond the money, you know, the thing that's more difficult to get hold of on a university campus than money is space, is building space. And so they didn't have a space to put us in. And so they ended up having to build a cinder block box for us to put our studios in. And that cost additional money they didn't want to spend. But we did eventually get that. And so I think the first, and you know, Paul, you know, can speak or not to the, you know, to the period that followed. It often is fraught, and we've seen in the States, right? You've seen out of San Francisco, out of Houston, lots of cities where you've had stations disappear because universities see them as just a hassle and not necessarily something that contributes to their bottom line, however they define it, whether that be financial or rankings or pulling in alumni support.
Sure. Andrew O'Boyle, I want to take that as an opportunity to ask Paula Healy about Andrew O'Boyle. You founded Flirt FM 25 years ago, which is one of the first college radio stations in Ireland that had volunteer community voices on the air on a sanctioned college radio station. And Paula Healy, you're Flirt FM's station manager. I wonder, you're in a unique opportunity to sort of explain to the Radio Survivor audience where you've come in 25 years. It's a long time to be on the air, but it's also a relatively shorter time compared to, you know, the span of radio culture in your country. So what is the place of college radio now in your community?
Well, talking about the span of while I've been there, I've basically been on a one-woman charm offensive to try and bring as many people in the university on board as possible. And I'm just really trying so hard to just prove how useful we are, how resourceful we are, all that kind of thing. So college radio it's so young compared to some of the stations I was talking to over World College Radio Day. They've been there for 60 years and I'm like, we're babies. But I think the place of college radio is, there's so many things that are coming up and that run from year to year to year, but they're ephemeral and they disappear, whereas the college radio stations are there year on year. Now, the ones that are part-time or temporary may have different managers, but the three student radio stations that have managers, they are some of the only things in the university that are a constant when it comes to student activities and extracurricular. And we're not going to disappear. You know, if you check out any of our social media feeds or if you come in and listen to the news headlines, that you're going to get what you expect or what you need. And that's something that was particularly noted during the start of the lockdown when people couldn't travel more than 2 kilometres from their houses. We found that we had more listeners than ever because they realised, oh, the college radio station is one of the few things that could keep going. Everything else was closed down, but we were recording news bulletins. We're doing stuff live from our kitchen. I'm doing this live from my kitchen right now. So that's a huge thing that college radio stations have. It is just the fact that they're still there, and we'd be there with like the college newspapers as well. But we run throughout the summer as well. We take a bit of time off for August and exam times at you know, Christmas or whatever it is. But it was definitely remarked upon that we kept going when literally nothing else did, and nothing else did. And you know, it's nice to see that after years of struggling and trying to say, like, listen, we are important, we are essential service, we do what we can, we bring in as many people as we can. We got on the 25th anniversary, apropos nothing, didn't know it was going to happen, got a beautiful letter from the university president who really, really said, we noticed that you kept broadcasting. We noticed that you were taking some of our webinars and rebroadcasting them because they were full of good research information. And thank you so much for doing that. And then one of our volunteers contacted the President of Ireland and he sent us down a lovely letter as well, which is gorgeous because he was the minister at the time. Michael D. Higgins was minister at the time, who actually started off community radio. He opened the station in 1995 or 96. He came back in 2009 when we restarted in the new building. And then he sent us this beautiful letter. So it's just, you know, after 6 very difficult months where we're trying to stay there and grit our teeth and hold on by our fingernails to make sure that we could keep going when it's been very difficult. And, you know, I haven't like broke down in tears, but I've been like definitely grinding my teeth more than usual. But to get that after the end of that just says, do you know what? People were listening and they appreciate it and they know how much work everybody put in. You know, staff, volunteers alike, and all the people that were guesting and stuff. So that's something that just really says, do you know what? College radio is still so important.
Well, that's a wonderful sentiment there to kind of close things up here in our discussion about Flirt FM, which is the community and college radio station at the National University of Ireland in Galway. You just heard from Paula Healy, the station manager for the station, Flirt FM, and we've also been talking to the founder of the station, now a lecturer at the university, Andrew O'Boyle. Thank you so much for joining us here on Radio Survivor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Well, that is the conclusion of today's radio episode of Radio Survivor. We come to you each week celebrating the world of community radio, college radio, sound studies, radio around the world. And it was what a pleasure, what a privilege to talk to our friends at Flirt FM in Galway, Ireland. You know, it's really heartening to make these connections here from the United States with our friends in radio around the world. We try to do that as often as we can here on Radio Survivor, even though we primarily cover North America and North American community radio. It's a big continent. We have a lot of fun doing so. And it's really also just a special treat to go overseas and talk about radio, because it's all radio, and we have a lot to learn from one another. Well, Radio Survivor airs each week here on this radio station where you're listening. We're also a podcast where you can subscribe anytime you would like, any way you subscribe to your podcasts. You can also find out more at radiosurvivor.com/podcast, where this episode is about 15 minutes longer than the radio version that you just listened to. You know, in the rest of the interview that airs in our podcast, we get into a little bit about Jennifer Waits had visited the radio station Flirt FM many years ago during the swine flu pandemic outbreak, and they were joking around because that pandemic was a little more lighthearted.